All right, good afternoon. Welcome to Saturday, April 6th version of House Resources. Time is about 1:08. Present members, Representative Seaton, Representative Hawker, Representative Parr, Representative Wilson, Representative Olson, Co-Chair Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Feige. Today we got two pieces of legislation to take up. The first one will be House Bill 163 from Representative Tammy Wilson, and then House Bill 198, a House Labor and Commerce Committee bill. So first up, Representative Wilson, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Representative Tammy Wilson. I represent District 2, which is the Fairbanks North Pole area. And before you, you have House Bill 163. This is a substitute House bill. It will establish a new emission standard for solid fuel burning devices within the EPA-designated PM2.5 non-attainment area in the state by allowing only the cleanest burning devices to be sold at local retail stores. Those who have a solid fuel device currently installed are grandfathered under the new emission standard and would not need to convert their devices. Currently, a PM2.5 non-attainment area has been designated by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency within the Fairbanks North Star Borough. During the winter months, air quality status can reach unhealthy levels for many of the people who reside within the non-attainment area, especially this last winter when, between November and December, our average temperature was negative 40. House Bill 163 ensures the most efficient EPA-certified appliances are installed as homeowners within this area naturally upgrade their units, saving Alaskans money by reducing the cost of space heating. Additionally, by installing the best technology, air quality at a neighborhood and regional level will also improve. This is important for the overall health of the communities and for achieving federal attainment. Finally, House Bill 163 guarantees an individual's right to use a solid fuel burning device in accordance with their budget and local and state law, which for our meaning means you can't burn anything in your wood stove. We want you to burn wood. The consequences of not reaching EPA attainment status stretch beyond health concerns. If attainment is not reached by 2014, and we do have a chance of being able to have that extended as long as we're doing things that, like this to make things better, the EPA could sanction the state of Alaska by withholding federal highway funds within the non-attainment area, which is basically the city of Fairbanks all the way to the city of North Pole and the outlying areas. So it's not the entire borough, but it is where the populated area, and it also includes Fort Wainwright. This would prevent many of Alaskan roads and transportation infrastructure from being constructed or upgraded. This is a proactive, and it was statewide bill, and will hopefully prevent additional communities from becoming there. That's one of the changes we should have made. We did have it a statewide where we had the couple changes that we made is that we looked at making it statewide to begin with because we truly believe if we had been more proactive as a community, we might not be in a non-attainment area now. To be a certified wood stove that goes up to 7 grams per hour and makes it certified. For our area with the inversion, we don't believe, and the EPA has helped us there, that we can meet attainment without going to some of the cleaner ones, to 2.5 grams per hour. The other portion that this does, it's kind of an interpretation. We have people interpret that it should say up to 200,000 BTUs. It did not say that, so they felt, the dealers, that if it was 100,000 BTUs, then it would be 1.25 grams per hour, which would have basically made it so no wood stove would have qualified, and that was not our intent of the bill. The bill was to make sure that we're burning cleaner ones up to that amount. Anything over 200,000 BTUs, which are more the commercial size, the DEC will then make regulations based on that. My intent, if you will adopt the CS, will be to take this back to the community, work on it more with the DEC, and hope that we have gas moving forward that will ultimately solve our problem. With that, Mr. Chair, I really appreciate you taking your valuable time today and hearing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. And before we continue, Representative Sadler?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we adopt as a working document CS for HB 163, version 28-LS0248/Romeo.
Hearing no objection from the committee, the CS is adopted as the working document. Questions for Representative Wilson? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilson, just for background, for those who aren't familiar as much with the situation in Fairbanks, how much of the non-attainment issues are the result of car emissions versus emissions from a wood stove or other burning stove?
Mr. Co-Chair, they're telling us over 50% of the issue is burning of solid fuel. So it is to our wood stoves.
Okay.
Representative Hawker, do you have a question?
If I might, with a quick check of the CS here, Mr. Chair, if Representative Wilson, are you comfortable, A, with the standards in Section C on page 2, and are you comfortable that the department will have time to adopt those regulations?
Through the Chair, Representative Hawker, yes. At this point, this will work the best for us. Part of this that you'll see in here, too, giving DEC some additional powers is that the coal burners that currently are being used within the borough are exempt when it comes to the EPA, so they're not tested at all. But I do want to make it clear that we are not looking for a whole new test model by the department. What we're looking for is the regulations to be clearly set so that company who wants to bring a device that is not currently certified by the EPA, they would go have the test completed and then submit those results, and that way they would be judged by DEC and they would be okayed or not, or approved.
It's a, Mr. Chair?
That's
the key. This is going to, I think there's really one area of the state this hits, and that's your part of the world. And if you're comfortable with it, I'm comfortable with it.
Through the Chair, Representative Hawker, just for clarification, Juneau right now is on the edge. They were a little bit quicker, had a smaller area, so they are not a non-attainment area, but they're kind of in the next plan that we're trying to get to. So hopefully by doing this as well, it will encourage the companies to actually make cleaner burning stoves, as our hopes.
Okay, thank you very kindly. I appreciate you bringing this one forward.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilson, for the for what I understand, that you actually are going to work with DEC in the next several months and try to come up with something, and then so if there's things in here that need to be tweaked a little bit, you'll know what they are and you'll come back before us next session and work on it then?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, absolutely. We're going to meet with them. We will also have meetings with the community as well as those dealers, because our intent is not to do harm, but to do good.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Torre.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's a really important issue. And my only suggestion, and since we know you're going to be working in the interim, is to perhaps pursue any opportunities with Department of Health and Social Services, because burning of some of these materials is linked to asthma and other health conditions, or you know, some of the things that would be prohibited, like the plastics that release the toxic fumes. They might benefit from, you know, sort of having some moment in time where those things weren't being used anymore, and then tracking any health issues. Because as I understand, it came up during DEC budget subcommittee that high rates of asthma because of the particulate matter in Fairbanks right now.
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, that list you're talking about are things we tell people not to use,
yeah,
and not to burn.
That's
They're already in regulations, but for our community, they feel, although I think here we know regulations don't change very easily,
mm-hmm,
they believe they would. The asthma is more from the burning of greener wood,
mm-hmm,
that doesn't combust to its fullest extent.
Mm-hmm.
And when the inversion comes in,
mm-hmm,
it just holds all the burning down to the ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you can imagine, as it gets to negative 35, negative 40, even those who might even be just using it for a backup system becomes not a backup system. And then on top of it, when we get to 450 or higher per gallon for oil,
mm-hmm,
it even causes more. So, you know, we've been making some of these steps in the right direction, mm-hmm, but it's hard for us to realize by looking at the air, because so many are also adding,
mm-hmm,
those in. And so this will make it to where everybody who buys a new stove, mm-hmm, will automatically be looking for the cleaner one,
mm-hmm,
because when you walk into a store, most of us don't ask, you know, what's the emissions, what's this,
mm-hmm,
you know, we like how that one will fit in our house or how this one looks, and this way it'll just make better choices available.
Okay, we've recently been joined by Representative Johnson and at long last by Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Councilman Sadler, do you have a question?
I do have a question. Along those, actually, I believe Paul's. But a question to the maker, the sponsor is, you talked about the people walking to a store and buying a new stove. What if there are stoves in inventory that do not currently meet this standard? Will they still be usable? What about those things? Is that going to be a burden on retailers?
Representative Sadler, that's part that we're going to work through with DEC. What I would imagine would happen is those would be able to, a list be sent to DEC so they know what's left in inventory. And outside the non-attainment area, they could still be sold, but it would be not bringing new ones back in. But yes, we were trying to hold the companies harmless.
Follow up on that.
Follow up, Representative Sadler.
Just because I'm not as familiar with the issues, how much more expensive is a high-performance, high-efficiency, low-particulate-emitting stove than a lesser-emission stove? Big difference?
Yeah. Representative Sadler, what we found, $100 to a couple hundred dollars a lot, doesn't have as much to do with the emission portion of it as it does to the looks of the stove.
The looks.
Representative Sadler, if you have glass in it or you have, you know, nice little curlicues on it, you know, it makes the stove cost more. Most of these stoves will have catalyst in it or don't have catalyst in it. And the catalyst are what makes them a lot cleaner.
Okay. Thanks. Good.
I'll bring pictures when I come back.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the backup material that has your letterhead there on the EPA certified wood stoves, as I'm reading it, in 1988 they had this accreditation for 7.5, and have they not got a new standard? I'm just a little confused. So are we just establishing the 2.5 grams per hour as a new standard that is going to be an Alaska-only standard, or has the EPA got another designation for 2.5 stoves?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, in that year is when they started certifying all stoves, and they go anywhere from 0.4 up to 7.5. A few years ago, the state of Washington had the same issue, and they are the ones that took this idea to start with, where they lowered the amount versus banning stoves altogether, which is what some communities have tried to do, especially because of the outdoor boilers putting a lot more out into the air shed. We were in hopes that the EPA was going to do this themselves with the manufacturers, just like they did with cars when they added catalysts and made them cleaner. We can't wait around for them any longer, so this would be a standard at this point that would only be for the non-attainment area. This would not be statewide. The PM2.5 issue would be for the non-attainment, and we are also going to look about possibly sunsetting this statute so that once, you know, you have reached the attainment, would no longer take place, because, you know, this really is very specific at this point.
Follow-up, Ripstein?
Thank you. So the EPA does the certification. We're not going to have a Alaska certification. The certification is done by the EPA laboratory, and those are then stickers or plaques that are on stoves saying what their particulate emissions are. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, that is for wood stoves and for qualified wood boilers. The coal units are exempt, masonry heaters are exempt, and so this would be the portion that DEC would be involved in setting a relevant equivalent standard between what EPA does, so that those who have those units, they would be required to go to a certain laboratory, however it's set up in regulations. They would have to have the test done. It would be their cost. And in the Fairbanks versus Arbroath does that currently, just underneath certification portions of it, where one of the coal units that are currently able to be into the Fairbanks versus Arbroath went to Omni, which is one of the certified areas, took their unit, their actual unit, and the coal, Healy coal, clean coal with them, had it tested right there, brought the results back, and they were approved underneath the same type of plan we're talking about for any units that are currently not certified or qualified by the EPA.
Thank you, Chair.
Question, Representative Wilson. You said the catalyst and the catalytic converter, essentially, in the top of these newer, more modern stoves is what helps to burn the contents more completely and cut down on the emissions or on the particulate emissions. Is it possible to retrofit older stoves with a kind of like an in-stack type of
catalyst, or is that not possible?
Mr. Chair, actually they have been doing some testing right now on what they're called pollution control devices, especially for the outdoor boilers. My understanding, they also have some electrostatic precipitators. Polk School has one of those in their bigger unit to be able to do it. What does the best job is burning your stove hot all the time at full blast. And what happens, though, is a little harder to control your wood stove than it is your furnace. And so what ends up happening is that people get it started in the morning. We put a whole lot into the air while we're starting it, and then they, you know, push it back so that the heat will generate while they're at work. But the catalyst will make them cleaner, will make them burn longer. Most of those are non-catalytic or 4.5 grams or higher. Mm. And we put it toward, and some of you guys are from Anchorage and Fairbanks, where we had our cars, we had to go through the IM program. I am a firm believer that the IM program was just a pain for most of us. It cost us a lot of money. Really what happened was the car dealership, the car manufacturers were forced to make their product cleaner and buy the older cars, pretty well dying off, and people buying newer models is why we don't have a CO issue. And personally, I think it's going to take other states who have the same issue to push back on the EPA and say, if you want us to meet these standards, you have to give us the kind of testing it does. And just so you know, they test these units in a big warehouse with certain kinds of wood, not the kind of wood that we would burn here, not underneath the cold temperatures. So even the standard that they're having right now, although they say, you know, 7.0 grams per hour, it's whether in negative 40 you get that same part when you're burning birch, even though it's been, you know, seasoned, we have severe doubts. And that's another reason why we believe by dropping it down to this level, we will get the cleaner ones, and we will hopefully get out of that issue without having a total ban on burning wood.
Further questions from committee? Representative Tarleton, Saddle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And not to bring up another piece of legislation, but
thank you.
Was there another bill that we had about loans for wood burning stoves, if I'm remembering correctly, and that would that help private homeowners, you know, to meet the standard, potentially the new standard?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, if you're talking about HB 35, which is close to my heart, what it would be is that it would be for changing out your furnace of any type of fuel to a more efficient one.
Oh, okay.
But when it would come to wood, it would have to be an automated system. So you could not exchange it for a wood stove where you're putting the wood in. But if you had an automated system, because that's what Alaska Housing Finance has as their portion of it, you could do that for an automated system.
Okay.
But thank you for bringing that up.
Representative Sutter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wilson, I want to make sure I understand the limitation. This would bar other municipalities, second-class cities, et cetera, from imposing either more rigorous or more lenient standards. And can you help me understand what the impact is on emissions? Because I'm reading through one of the fiscal notes here. Says it would limit municipalities from adopting particulate air contamination emission standard other than the standard adopted by regulation by the state.
Mr. Co-Chair, that is an old fiscal note that is on the other version. And that will be updated, and hopefully will be a zero fiscal note, because at that point we're looking at statewide, and also I think CDC believe that we were looking for them to do the testing and set up a whole regulation. That was not our intent, so as we vet this out and have it re-looked at, we hope to get that lowered down to where it belongs.
Good deal. I'm up with it. Other different topic for me?
Follow-up, Representative Satter.
You've eloquently expressed to us the ramifications for Fairbanks and Interior North Pole if the attainment is not reached. Does having this bill make progress or get passed help you delay EPA's implementation of sanctions or loss of federal highway funds or anything? How much is this going to do to help alleviate that situation?
Mr. Co-Chair, we are required to have what's called a state implementation plan. Mm-hmm. And within that plan, this would fit into there. The more ways that we show the EPA that we're trying to get there gives us an extension on meeting those qualifications. I think the EPA, as they've been working closely with, realizes that it's going to take a different type of fuel, primarily gas, unless this committee would like to give us oil for about $1 a gallon. That might get us there. But ultimately, it is going to be a different source. So as long as we are working toward lowering it, they are very good about working with us. And on the impact, too, it does impact our military bases as well. They have to take it into account when they bring new troops up that we are in a non-attainment area. So it has a lot of effects. And we're trying to work on it in a way to where we don't do the opposite and our residents don't have anything to do but move out because they can't afford the alternative.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Any more questions from committee? No, Representative Wilson has another committee meeting to get to, so at this time we'll take House Bill 163, set it aside.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you for the...
Mr. Chairman. Representative Seed.
Sorry. The question had come up about the, on page 3, lines 10, a state or local authority may not adopt a particular air containment emission standard for solid other than the standard adopted by regulations under C of this section. Is that statewide requirement necessary in this bill if we're only talking about the non-attainment area?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's my understanding that's already part of state law. That's not something that we added. But we will look at that to see if that needs... We'll make that part of the discussion with the department.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please go quickly.
Nothing personal.
All right. Next up, House Bill 198. Be presented by Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson. The bill before the committee today, House Bill 198, turned the wrong piece of paper over, I apologize, relating to the primary period of an oil and gas or gas-only lease. Currently under AS 3805180M, an oil and gas lease may be extended automatically if and for so long as oil or gas is produced in paying quantities from a leased area, or if the lease is committed to a unit by the unit approved by the commissioner. What House Bill 198 would do is provide the commissioner of Department of Natural Resources the ability to grant a one-time extension from the primary period of the oil and gas or gas-only lease. The total time of the period of the lease and the extension could not exceed 10 years. Further on in the bill, we set out the requirements that the commissioner may require of lessees as a condition of the extension. There are requirements about towards the tail end of Section 2 that do require an increase to $250 per acre per year for the final 3 years of the total term. There are also conditions which the commissioner may take into consideration in reducing that rate, again, a commissioner's discretion. The end of the bill, Section 4, does provide transition language to deal with those extensions, or those leases, pardon me, which would be expiring very close to the effective date of the bill. The intent is to be fair with all lessees and make sure that everybody has an opportunity to apply for the extension. We feel that the bill is a win-win. It's a win for the state of Alaska with the attempt, as everyone has been discussing this legislative session, of producing more oil. Gas is always a nice little bonus. It's also a win for the explorers and producers that are right on the edge of a lease expiring and are just very close to being able to begin production or begin that exploration and just need a little more time. Again, it is hoped that everybody benefits across the board. And Mr. Chairman, as you can see, the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Bill Barron, is here, and he has a little presentation, I believe, is in everyone's packet, and has probably forgotten more about oil and gas leases than I will probably know. So if the committee will indulge, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Barron.
Hey, Mr. Barron, take it away.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Bill Barron, the Director of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska. And as the presentation comes up, I do want to thank the committee for meeting on Saturday and taking the opportunity to hear this bill. As Conrad very eloquently rolled out the bill. The important part is to understand that right now there's nobody within the administration or within the legislature that can extend a lease, a short-term lease, beyond its primary term. And that is a real gap in our policy.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Is there a reason why it can't be extended, or was it just an accidental loophole that it's there?
Through the chair, Representative, I actually believe it was an oversight.
Okay.
I have not seen or heard of any record that it was clear that was going to be the way it should be. I think it's, as we've gone through this, and some of that is a very important question, we have the statutory authority to lease up to 10 years, but no less than 5 years. So over time, and this is a bit of a background slide, is over time the division has played and toyed with the 5 year, 7 year, 10 year, the terms, the conditions, all the time in an effort to try and motivate exploration. There was a thought that the shorter you give them, that would encourage them to get out there as quickly as possible. The downside of that is, with given some of the drilling windows we have, to mobilize seismic, to shoot the seismic, to interpret the seismic, to restack it and reinterpret it to make sure that you know where you're going to drill, then to get a drilling rig under contract and get it on location, you've already burned up probably 5 years. So that while it was in good intention and very sound logic, it sometimes just doesn't really work. Now, a five-year lease term on the east side of Cook Inlet, where you've got road infrastructure, you've got longer drilling seasons, five-year windows might tend to work a little bit better. So there was some bantering over time. But what we found out and what we recognized was that there were players who were coming in who were diligently working their lease right up to the end, and then instead of being able to push through the project at the very end, they were running out of time and bringing to the division unit applications that were not fully fleshed out. So we were having to try and process units rather than allowing companies to actually do the exploration drilling to prove the hydrocarbon rather than just work off of a potential hydrocarbon. A very key difference there. So what we're trying to do here is, this is not, and I want to make sure everybody is very clear, this is not about warehousing. This is about companies who have been diligent over the primary term. So if they've got a five-year term, for 4 years or 4.5 years, they've been working the project hard. They've shot seismic. They've tried to get a rig. They've been doing work. This is an opportunity for them to come in and say, you know, I just need a couple more years, or I just need one more year. So it is not an automatic extension. This is something that they would have to petition the division, the department, and come forward with. What kind of work have they done? What kind of money have they spent? What have they found? What are their current plans? At that juncture, it becomes a bit of a negotiation, because their lease is a contract. And for them to want to come in, what this statute allows is the division now to renegotiate contractual terms. So that's the second issue that is of really key importance for this committee to embrace, is at that time, if they want an extension, they're essentially asking for an option. Well, options come at a premium. So this will be the first time that the division can actually sit down with the company and say, I understand your problem. I'm sympathetic. You have been doing work. I will grant the extension. However, you will have a drilling program. It will be, there will be hard and fast work commitments established and signed as a new contract for the extension. And all of this is in the $250 per acre that Conrad mentioned. Those are right now in the last several lease sales that we've had. Because one thing we talked to with many in the industry, they said 7 years is good. We can probably get most of the work we want done in seven. But, the three extra would be good. So in our current lease terms, we said, understand that. 7 years is good at the low entry level of about $25 an acre. If you haven't done work, your leases go up to $250 per acre. So it's a business call. The industry is really good at making business decisions. That's what they do for a living. So we're giving them an opportunity to make a business decision. If they haven't done work, the leases go up to $250. If they've been doing work, the commissioner can reduce that to whatever level he deems necessary. Same thing here. I don't know that we would probably ever be able to get into the 250 because if, for example, somebody came in with a five-year lease and if we were to grant them a full five-year extension, we would be building, in theory, and the concept that we've been working on in the division is we would be building yearly thresholds, yearly gates that they would have to pass through for work commitments. And if they didn't pass those gates, maybe even the first one, the lease would be expired. So while the 250 is there as an option, it's not necessarily something we would use as a routine basis. The real key is the work commitments. This would be the first time that the division of the state can actually lean into the companies and get work programs established. So let's talk about what's the impact. I mean, let's kind of, how big is this problem that we're trying to deal with? The slide that you have on the screen and in your packet is, this is for the North Slope area, Foothills and North Slope. This is a collection of data that we pulled together, and it represents the number of companies by name and the number of leases that they have that are going to expire in the first shaded area in the next 2 years. The middle column is between 2 and 5 years, and the outside column is in within 5 years. Clearly, in this case, it's clearly a mix of companies. That mix changes a bit over time, which is something you would expect during the normal course of the lease programs. Repsol is a big player, as you can see. ABG is right behind them. There's some smaller players. There's some bigger players. It's kind of all over the map. Repsol is a very interesting story. Repsol was not at the original lease sale. They came in and acquired these leases through a business arrangement with Armstrong. And this is a kind of company that recognizing that they were stepping into a short time frame, actually became very aggressive in their drilling activities and mobilization. That's the kind of activity that we would be hoping to encourage and reward by this kind of extension opportunity.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad Repsol is a great example here. In your initial, Repsol is a really great example here. In your initial testimony, you talked about affording the latitude within the agency to extend these leases for someone, quote, who had been diligent over the primary term. And I wanted to make certain that it is your intent that this legislation also covered someone who is a successor interest. Not, you know, again, they didn't have the ability to be diligent over the primary term, but a successor interest that demonstrates and is willing to meet and put up the whatever additional requirements you might place upon that extension.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that is clearly the intent. What we look at is when somebody buys into the lease, they're buying into the contract with the state. They effectively step into the shoes of the other company. That being said, if they stepped in with a year to go, it will be very difficult for them to have made substantial activities, substantial work programs. That kind of case, it will be a difficult call because they know going in that they only had 1 year, so they better get after the program or they risk a very blunt no from the commissioner's office. Typically, companies know that. So if they're not really ready to go, they would just as soon probably let that lease expire and pick it up in the next lease sale, at which time they would probably have 10 years to do their work effort. But the Repsol case is a very good one that we want to try and replicate the activity that they did as they came in really aggressive. They knew they were in a short window. They worked diligently with the state and got work programs moving forward. Those are the kind of things we want to see happen. So, yes, if somebody stepping in the shoes, will be treated just as fine as somebody who had originally had the lease.
Thank you very much.
The next graph that you see,
Representative Wilson, excuse me.
I have a question, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that, okay, when they lease an area and they only have so long to develop it, they've got those 5 years, what is the next step? Either the lease goes back to the state and somebody else can do it, or if they make it, then what is their next step, actually producing oil or whatever?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, thank you for the question. Let's work off of the failure path first. The failure path is during their primary term, they just don't get anything done. They can relinquish the property. It will expire, and it is returned to the state for the next lease sale. They have an opportunity to pick it back up, or a competitor to pick it back up. In that case, what this bill is trying to do is we recognize that as a problem because somebody may have been doing a lot of work, and they have the best knowledge. They've got the best understanding of the geology. They've got the plan laid out. It's in the state's best interest to give them another year or two to complete the work that they had already started. To your point, or the second question,
Before you go any further, if they don't do it, does the state get that information that they had, or do they keep it? Who owns the information, the geologic information that they got and everything? Do they have to give it to the state, or who owns it?
Through the chair, that is held by the company.
Okay.
Seismic information is typically released to the state, but then that is held in confidence.
Unless they acquire it under an exploration credit.
That's correct. If they get it under a tax credit regime, the state would get that information. On the success path, they have been able to do their due diligence, drill wells, are successful. They would come to the division and for a unit application, and they would unitize the area that they felt was the productive. And at that time, that property, all the leases associated with the unit, are held as long as the unit is in stake. So that they get to keep the land after that.
And that's as long as that unit is producing.
That's correct. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Representative Satter.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Barron, is there a chance the extra per acreage, basically going from $25 an acre to $250, for that remaining 3 years or however long the extension might be, actually pretty expensive, up to $1 million for 4,000 acres. Would that change the economics such that even if they want to continue, it might not be affordable to do so?
Through the chair, that is a possibility, but what we're trying to do there is give that as an option for us to utilize it. It's not necessarily that we will. It's an option that we may.
You can go up to that point?
We can go up to that point. So, again, it's part of that negotiation when you're sitting across the table saying, okay, here's the deal. I want a well drilled. But one of the pieces that's in there in the language is also performance bonding. So perform, you establish the bond, say, for example, to drill a well, $10 million to drill a well. We may require an $8 million or $10 million bond. If they don't perform, the state keeps the bond. If they do perform, the bond is released back to them. What we're trying to do is get companies to have real skin in the game and commit to the state of work activities that they're going to perform on state land in a timely manner. So the $250, while it's maybe deemed as extreme, is really the last thing that we would probably pull. Because if they've been doing all this work, if they had been doing, as I was referencing to Representative Wilson, if they've been doing and being due diligent in all that effort, that $250 probably wouldn't have been exercised by the commissioner anyway, because the entire point of the $250 is if you haven't done work, it is a value that the state has now put on its land.
It's an extra nudge.
It's exactly right. So in theory, I mean, while it's in the bill, in theory and in concept, it probably would never get action because we would probably never get to that point. But it's another level. This slide is a representation of the players in the Cook Inlet. Again, kind of a smattering. Clearly, the big player in this group is Apache. Apache has picked up quite a sizable acreage play on the east and west side of the inlet, and we're glad to have them. They have been very aggressive. But what I want to make sure of is this is not this the intent of this bill is not to give people an extension simply to shoot seismic. And I'm not trying to point it at any one company with that comment. There's a great deal of push to try and get as much seismic shot as possible. When you've got a spattering of land on both sides, onshore, nearshore, offshore, there's land everywhere that they just people need to aggressively do the work that they need to do. It's important for the committee to understand that you do not have to own the lease to shoot seismic. You can get a land use permit from the state and shoot seismic. So owning the lease is not a requirement to shoot seismic. So that's a key point that everybody needs to embrace.
Brief question. Representative.
Yeah, I may be betraying a basic misunderstanding of some things. I'm looking at the number of leases. Would the acreage covered by the leases have that same proportion?
Through the chair, relatively so, especially in the Cook Inlet. There's some of them are smaller and some of them are larger. But in general, our leases are 3 miles by 3 miles. Okay. So a quick rule of thumb, if you're trying to do the calculation, is, like in the first column, you have 88 leases total, indicated by the 88 underneath the expiring in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
You could do the 88 times 3 by 3 miles and come up with how many total acres are up. So
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Now, I know, like, the seismic work that Apache was trying to do got held up with permits, federal permits, and some other things. Is there anything in there, if the work commitments are done, if they've done staging and everything, and then they get the permits aren't granted, or anything, does that come into this two-year expiration term, or would that come into the analysis of what they came forward with?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the intent would be that it would be on a case-by-case basis, and the company would have to come in and show a justification of what work they've done, what work they're planning to do, how they're going to execute it, and what has been a barrier to them to get that work done. So in many cases, we actually expect companies to come in with bundles, packet A, B, and C, and we have the clear understanding that what we're going to do is look at each one of those packets. That would be a bundle of leases. They may be in a grouping. The area, say it's on the north slope from west to east, and we would look at what they have done in group A and may grant them an extension for area A with certain specific work programs. They may not have done anything on activities for group C, so we would say no to that group, and it's very discretionary. But again, it's part of it's part of the dialogue. We're trying to form a business relationship with the companies to get work done in the state. So that goes back to the benefits. The companies know that they, with the short drilling seasons and other issues that confront them, short-term leases have created a bit of a problem for us, a bit of a conundrum that we're trying to solve with this bill. So the lessees that have had those short-term leases who have been doing work, we're giving them an opportunity to finish up, to cross the finish line on that initial term. For the state, this is the first time that the state can actually lean in and require a work program. It encourages the work to be completed that's been planned, and this, we truly believe, will increase the probability of bringing leases onto production quicker for the state.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A bit of a rhetorical question, but I'd just like to ask and get on the record. We've got the charts here of north, we've got the charts of south. Do you believe that it is appropriate and beneficial to the state that this be a law of general application that applies both north and south?
Through the chair, yes, sir, I do. I think the leasing programs and what this bill allows us to do is in the future, regardless of where we have area-wide leasing, in the future, if there's ever a short-term lease issued, it gives us the ability to manage that lease at a much higher level.
And if I might follow up,
Rep. Walker.
My second question is, does the agency, do you respond to critics who might suggest that we're essentially opening up a secondary market in lease futures here where someone can bid, grab a lease, just simply hang on to it for the purposes later of flipping it to an adjacent holder or someone after they've done their own work, sort of a secondary market in lease futures, the speculators?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Fox, that's a pretty interesting question. What I would anticipate is if somebody had been diligent and doing work, they may not be in a position to want to flip it. The secondary market may not be there. It may be added value. The other thing to think about is, I kind of ponder your question, if the secondary player that's coming in has actually got more financial wherewithal than the first player, that is actually an advantage to the state, because now we have people that do have the financial strength to complete the work and bring it under production. Players who might be deemed as speculators who bought the lease originally probably haven't been doing any work on that land. So it's difficult to jump the first hurdle of what work have you done. If you haven't done any, then it's going to be a very high hurdle for them to come into my door. So the secondary market is there now, and it's a fairly robust market. I think you see that not only with the work that's done in the Cook Inlet. Over time, you see that, and I use Repsol again as the example. That's a secondary lease market. And it is a piece of the industry that is does bring value. People who acquire properties but don't do anything tend to drag down the value of the property, only to be flipped to somebody who might is a good thing.
Which I would absolutely agree with. And again, I contemplated the same legislation before it was introduced by its sponsor. I had a much harder time getting over this point. What's, again, that sidebar of what I don't know that it's a desirable outcome for someone to be allowed to buy, essentially tie up leased land, do very little, flip it to an incredibly competent, qualified new operator, and the new operator to be able to take off with another 5 years without the land having reverted to the state and going through a competitive bidding process.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that is why it is a one-time extension, and the time is not at all locked into 5 years. It may be a one-year extension. It may be a two-year, but it is that's the concern we had, and that's why we clearly labeled it as a single one-time extension, time to be determined, and work program to be determined by the department. For that very reason, we were concerned about somebody wanting and just holding it for 5 more years. That was not the intent, and that's why we had the work programs put in place and the single extension.
Last comment from me, but again, if I'm holding, basically I bought a lease. I didn't do a thing with it. I apologize. I've lost my voice the last couple of days here. But I bought a lease. I've done nothing with it. I'm holding it. I'm down to my last, you know, clearly within a time frame that nothing can be done. There's not a lot of value left there. But if I know I can flip it to someone who has the wherewithal, can come to the agency and run with it, in some ways this is subsidizing the value of my lease. This, you know, it's the state. I mean, that provides an intrinsic value to someone who otherwise has failed completely in their obligations to invest and develop on a leased property.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, the clear example that you gave at that point, there would probably not be an extension granted because no work had been done by the first owner.
I'm just wondering if there's some, and Mr. Chair, just for us, I'm just wondering if there's something there we ought to do to tune this up to that degree. I mean, quite frankly, this is the issue why I personally didn't pursue this same legislation earlier in the session. Plus, I had a real small other little bill I'm working on.
Seems to me, Mr. Barron, the risk of being able to get an extension or not would then be taken up by the second purchaser. And that risk, as you got closer to the end term of the lease, would increase significantly. So the better option for the initial lessee is to actually flip it fairly quickly, which still would leave time for work to be accomplished, and significant work even to be accomplished, given that these are mostly competitive bids, correct?
The original leases are competitive.
All competitive bids. So you really don't have any control over who's the high bidder. This could certainly result in better, more highly capitalized companies coming to the lease and being able to actually do more work than the original lessee. So,
yes, sir.
I guess we can let the market decide or not. Rep Wilson, and then Rep C.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So why doesn't it automatically revert back to the state and you start over? Because the fact that you only have the leases out so often. I mean, why doesn't, if someone doesn't do their job and don't work it, why can't the state just take it back?
Representative, through the chair, Representative Wilson, the lease, the primary lease term is a contract with a company that they have the exclusive right to work that land for the term of the primary term. The right now, the state does not impose work obligations during the primary term.
Okay.
So a company can get the land, and in their current terms with a 10-year lease, they can hold it for 10 years. But to your point, that's why we instituted the $250 uplift in the last 3 years to encourage companies to make wise business choices.
Follow up? So explain to me a little bit, if somebody can buy the lease from this original person, explain to me, do they pay, evidently he's going to make a profit?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am. The way that process, that is a business arrangement between two independent parties. Party A owns the lease, Party B wants to own the lease, or wants to own part of the lease. They enter into a private negotiation, come to closure on the deal, and then they come to the division and say, we've added new working interests, and we modify the lease assignment language to reflect that they now have new owners. The state has no dialogue associated with that. This is just a business transaction, a land transaction. You're buying and selling a car.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to...
Very good. Rep. Seaton, Sadler, then Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, before we talk about no value being brought by a speculator, you know, some of the companies that are recruited to come to the state are recruited by those people that have purchased a lease and now go out and find companies that have the wherewithal to come up and drill. And so that is one of the mechanisms that have brought a number of these companies to the state, you know, whether it's Repsol with Armstrong or whether it's Donkel has brought some others. So although, you know, this idea of they didn't have the wherewithal to drill, but they definitely have the incentive to be able to flip the lease, but they have to have someone to buy it. And so they have to go out and convince people that there is resource there, that they're, you know, to come invest. So I'm less concerned about people going out and selling a lease, because that means they had to convince somebody to come in and buy it. And what I really like about this extension part is that one of the things we found on our Norway trip that Norway had that we don't was Norway has very definite work commitments, and so when somebody has a lease, they've got to do it, otherwise they lose the lease at the third year if they haven't done their seismic. Guess what, they're out. So I think these work commitments are a real benefit for us moving forward and getting actual production done. So anyway, I did want to add that, but I had a question on the bill on page 2. We've got on line 14 that if a lease is not automatically extended under the subsection, but both on line 10 and on line 29, we are deleting automatic extensions. So just language-wise, if we've eliminated automatic extensions, and then we're referencing if they're not automatically extended, I just want to make sure that as we go forward here, that it's considered that we still have something if we no longer have an automatic extension. So
through the chair, Representative Seaton, you do have automatic extension as it's described in the packet when the property is in a unit or under current production, mm-hmm. or held by production. So that is the only way to have automatic extension.
Follow up. So we've changed the language. We've taken the automatically extended out in both places, and we've substituted shall be extended beyond its primary term by these other things. I just want to make sure that we have it referenced correctly so that we since we're eliminating automatic extension, I mean, that's the effect of it, but we've eliminated the terminology. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure the sponsor can look through that and just make sure that we have our language correct.
I think they just moved automatic extension down to line from line 10 down to line 14. That's kind of how I read it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's no, if we've taken out on line 10 that an oil and gas lease shall be automatically extended, we've eliminated automatic extensions. And now we're saying that if it's not automatically extended, but we no longer have in statute in this section automatic extension, you know, we may need to reference if it's not extended beyond its primary term by the other provisions of the chapter or something. Mm-hmm. And I may be incorrect. There may be another reference in there or something. I'm just trying to make sure that we have the wording so that it all works and we're not too blocked. And we may not be. That's why I'm asking the question.
Through the chair, Representative Saint, I think it's... We are comfortable, and I think the sponsor is comfortable, with the language that says that it's extended beyond the primary term once it's, you know, et cetera, producing and paying quantities from the lease. So that language is the clear way that the lease is extended, as long as it's in a unit or producing.
Because it does say shall, at the start of line 10, shall be extended. And then if at the end,
rather than automatically,
and you have production at the end of the primary term.
Yeah.
If I may, Mr. Chair, so that's just, rather than saying automatically extended, it says extended beyond its primary term, meaning the same thing.
Yeah.
Shall be this what preface.
Shall be.
Shall be extended. Mm-hmm. And then if oil or gas is produced in paying quantities, so yeah,
That's fine. I was just wanted to bring it up since I thought we were eliminating the term automatically extended, and then we're using it in another place. Mm-hmm. So,
no, I think the essence of the automatically extended is maintained. Let's see, Rep. Sadler, then Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Is this bill likely to change the DOG's policy on lease terms? Currently, are you going to stick with the 5 or 7 years to try and encourage people, or are you going to make them automatically all 10 years, or is it likely to be any change in policy on the term of leases that you issue here and out?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the current position of the division is that we really like the 10 years, what we call the 3 plus 7, or the 7 plus 3,
mm-hmm.
because that ability for the division to grant a 10-year lease but have that elevation in rental rates in the last, you know, years 8, 9, and 10 to encourage work done in 7 really fits well with a good business practice. I think it's important to understand that those kind of leases would not be eligible for any extension. So this bill does not affect the current lease, the lands that are now going under the lease, because they are originally 10-year leases, and we don't breach beyond 10 years.
Maybe a conceptual thing here. So the 7 plus 3 is actually a 7-year lease?
No, sir. It's a 10-year lease. We just call it a 7 plus 3 because the first 7 is under the low rental rate, the last 3 are on the elevated.
Balloon payment lease kind of thing. Okay.
That's the way they put it. So what this does is it clearly gives the division an ability to manage its land over the next probably 5 years that were part of original lease sales that were 5-year and 7-year leases. What this also does is if we were to have an area where we wanted to have another 5-year lease or 7-year lease, this would also give us the ability at that point to manage those lands as a short-term lease mentality. So, no, we really do enjoy the 10-year term, but we really do like the uplift in years 8, 9, and 10.
So is it fair to say that the division does not issue 5-year leases anymore?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. So it's more of an escalator than a balloon. But yeah, okay.
So you already built the nudge into the current 10-year leases?
Yes, sir, we have.
Okay, I got you. Representative Olson, then Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I shared Representative Hawker's concerns as the bill was being drafted and did not want to end up with something that could be gained or used to warehouse a significant amount of acreage. And I think that what we have come up with meets those needs, and I think we're in pretty good shape. But we also had other bills going on at that same time, and I may have got part of them confused briefly, but I think this is a good bill, and I would encourage everybody to consider supporting it if we got that part today.
I know you were only confused briefly.
Oh, I was getting real confused two nights ago, three nights ago, at about 2:17 a.m.
Not me. No. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why do you not have work commitments in that first lease? Why do we not do that? That's just the question.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we're not statutorily allowed to. But let's step back and ask a bit more of a philosophical question. To the point of Norway. Norway spends a great deal of money and in building consortiums to get seismic information, seismic data, that they then make public to companies that are interested in leasing their property before they lease it. We don't do that. We the United States, let alone just we, Alaska, do not do that. So when somebody walks in and buys a lease, in theory and in basic concept, they really don't know what's underneath them. So for us as a state, as a group of administrators and regulators, to impose work programs on areas that are highly speculative, may not have anything, for us to be so presumptuous that we can tell somebody to what to do and when to do it on areas that are truly exploration, I believe is really an unfair hurdle to jump. And I think the industry would step away from it because we would be the only state to require it, to my knowledge.
Representative Wilson, follow up.
So Norway actually hires someone to do the seismic so that they know what it is?
They yes, ma'am, they do.
Wow.
And that is an expense to the country, and it's an expense to the consortium that does it. And then their tracks, again, our leases are 3 miles by 3 miles. Theirs are, in some cases, 20 by 20, 30 by 30. They are large, large blocks of land. Significantly different than our leasing program. I mean, it's two ends of the spectrum.
Thank you.
Let's see, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, and I guess just following up on Norway, they do 2D seismic for the leasing, and then their work commitment is generally within 3 years that the company that gets the lease has to shoot 3D seismic. Mm-hmm. So it's a seismic as a work, you know, to further identify and move forward. I guess, you know, the question of warehousing through applying for a lease, I guess, since we've got this before us, can you explain if the lease is committed to a unit, then it's held forever, even if there's no drilling or production on that unit? So I guess I'm concerned that we have, I have no problem at all where oil or gas is produced in paying quantities and it's held as long as that goes forward. But what is the usefulness of having an totally open-ended, once somebody's applied for a unit, we've established a unit, and then they really don't have to produce it?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, typically unit agreements have, some have 5-year clocks and some have 10 years. So if no production is on a unit, it has an automatic expiration date on it. That is part of the unit agreement. I don't know of any unit. Well, there's only one major unit in the Cook Inlet right now that does not have any production in it, and they are aggressively drilling, having a drilling program for the last two summers. I think there's, gosh, I will probably step on myself here. I think there's only 4 to 6 wells that are holding acreage deemed as paying in production but aren't on production in the entire state. So it's not a big issue. Typically, and that's why the division is a bit dogged these days, no pun intended, about having units formed based on proven hydrocarbons, not potential hydrocarbon, even though that's in the regulation. We can form a unit based on potential. What we are driving hard for is the well to be drilled and the resource to be proven, and that's when we form units, not beforehand. So it's really important that we are doing everything we can to ensure that there is a known hydrocarbon resource. Once it's known, it's really not in any company's best interest not to bring it on, not to produce, because they've got all the expense. They're paying rentals. They've got an asset base that they will enjoy the revenues from as soon as they get it online.
So on line 12 here, for so long thereafter as oil or gas is produced in paying quantities from the lease, and then on line 13, or if the lease is committed to a unit approved by the commissioner. So the lease, if it's committed to a unit, then I guess I'm thinking of West Eagle out, in my area. There was a lease needed to be drilled, and then there that was being held by unitization or application for a unit.
Held by application.
Held by application. And so then in that unit application, you're able to put in work commitments. Is that what I'm understanding?
Through the chair, at the time of unitization, when the application came in, is when we were able to impose a work program.
Okay.
At unitization.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Barron, as I recall, the division does more than just oil and gas leasing. Are there other lease programs that this could apply to or this could be useful in?
Mr. Chairman, it's possible. The only other leases we engage in are geothermal.
Okay.
And that's a program that really hasn't grown very much. It's a very, very small piece of the business. This one is clear. It's possible, to answer your question. It's a possibility. This one is clearly targeted for the oil and gas sector.
And I would infer then that although you do have other lease programs at this time, you don't see the utility of extending it to that.
Okay. That's correct.
Fair enough. Any other questions? Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Mr. Barron, do many companies do, as you said earlier in your testimony here, get a land use permit? I mean, actually, Conrad said it's possible to get a land use permit and go out and shoot seismic. Do many companies avail themselves of that opportunity to do so without actually having to buy a lease?
Through the chair, not so much anymore. As I sit here with many gray hairs in my head, that's the way that companies used to do it. They used to go out and shoot seismic on spec. In fact, there's still seismic companies that shoot seismic on spec and then sell the seismic. So seismic companies actually do it, not necessarily oil and gas companies. The oil and gas companies will then buy the spec seismic for future lease sales. So that's still part of the business of the seismic companies.
Yeah, follow up and slight expansion. So just help educate the amateurs here. What are the biggest delays in the process from leasing to delineation to exploration and production? Just where's the gap in that? Where's the slowdown in that process usually come from?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, clearly the one of the first parts is acquiring seismic. Apache, as diligent a company as they are, have run into many hurdles relative to acquiring federal permits to gain access to federal land. That is a hurdle. The more complicated the area is geologically, the more the 3D seismic takes time to process and reprocess and restack, reanalyze. So the more complicated the area in terms of geologic parameters, that can take several years to process correctly, because you don't want to drill a well in the wrong spot. It depends on the area after that. Securing a location to drill a well and even potentially the ability to secure a rig could be a hurdle to jump. While not a major hurdle, because if it's a good prospect, companies have the ability to find rigs and bring rigs into the state. even if they're there for just even one or two drilling seasons. But mobilization of a rig and equipment. Beyond that, it's clearly permitting. It's making sure that you have all the permits in place, and we've had some of that discussion on another bill that passed this body in terms of trying to get an idea of exactly what activities are associated with that general area and then streamline the entire permitting process. So, again, this is just time value of money kind of discussion. But it can take, especially in the winter season on the North Slope, the big hurdle for them is you've got only really 3 months to drill, have a drilling activity. That, you know, if you think about a 10-year lease program and you only have 3 months a year to drill, you really don't have 10 years. I mean, you would really only have about four.
And with the chair's indulgence here, there's an issue I heard about that there's some challenges in getting a certain company the ability to shoot seismic along the borders of the wildlife refuge in the Kanab Peninsula. Is that an example of the kind of permitting delays that can happen? Is there anything you'd like to educate us about that?
Through the chair, certainly. Representative Sadler. Yeah, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and I don't have all the particulars on it, but several companies can join in with testimony in the later regard, but the U.S. Fish and Wildlife in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge is allowing seismic activities to take place on native inholdings and only to the border of those inholdings. They're not allowing any of the seismic activity to cross the boundaries outside the native inholding lands. That could be a crippling event in terms of the ability to get really good seismic, because you're trying to get as much information on a lateral and then horizontal perspective as you possibly can. So by truncating where they can put their receivers is detrimental, and it's a very onerous process to get activities accomplished on federal land. They've also got issues and activities associated with endangered species habitats, and those activities have got to be managed through the federal organizations, and rightfully so. But unreasonably withholding permission to do that kind of work is a real burden. One of the biggest concerns that a lot of companies has is we can just look to Shell. How many years have they been held up just by lawsuits? So, I mean, that's always the opportunity of another delay is the lawsuits, regardless of how well we do permitting reform within the state, is the ability for people, parties, and individuals to stop activities through legal action, which clearly within their rights.
Which brings us back to the bill and the question before us, so thank you very much.
Are there any provisions in the lease agreements, in the standard lease agreements, such that if there is a delay, say, beluga whales and Cook Inlet, that lease could then be extended?
No, sir.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any possibility we could make the time easier? And I don't know how much up there is there very much state land up there, so that we could say yes, you could on state land you could have permanent roads in some of those areas.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, are you referring to the North Slope?
Yeah.
Quite candidly, I am an unabashed supporter of roads to resources. I think that's an opportunity that the state should investigate very strongly. I would also offer that West Cook Inlet is another area that the state should investigate strongly of having permanent roads. If you look clearly on the North Slope, as good as the industry did its job in terms of Alpine and Badami, and now Point Thompson, every year ice roads are built from Dead Horse to Badami. Every single year, because it's a roadless development. And yet there is a gap of land between there that could have had additional exploration cheaper more timely by having short ice roads off of a permanent road if there had been one built to Badami. Same thing with Alpine. It's a great development, great roadless kind of idea, but from Kapar to Alpine is another gap where there's no roads, and that is an impediment to exploration. West Cook Inlet, it's very clear if you were to take a map of the Kenai Peninsula and fold it in half down the inlet and then open it back up and look at where there's development and where there's not. It's not so much that the geology has changed dramatically. There is a change, clearly, because it's a wide area. But the marked difference between the west side and the east side has one simple common denominator. One side has roads, one side does not. And having the ability to move equipment and people quickly up and down a road system makes all the difference in the world. Why is North Dakota, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Colorado, California, Ohio, why are all those states, having some robust development versus us? Part of that is another discussion at another committee right now, but part of that is infrastructure. The lack of general infrastructure in the state is an impediment.
Thank you.
Yeah, on the North Slope, if you have a low snow year and you have to build a 100-mile ice road to get your equipment in, pretty soon it's the middle of March by the time you actually get to drill, and you got to pull up stakes by the early part of May, so it's not much of a window.
And the folks chasing Umiad have even got a bigger problem. The foothills is even harder to build ice roads in. Because of the way the terrain of the land is, it's not flat like the North Slope is. It's an undulated area where you've got to fill in those gaps and valleys to have a smooth road. So it's even harder.
Representative Wilson.
Commissioner, is there a chance to get the fiscal note zeroed out by chance?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's actually a good idea. When we first put this together, I mean, we kind of ask ourselves, isn't this within our own ability to budget and estimate? And the answer was, yeah, it really was within, kind of within our knowledge set. It should be zero. But being kind of sort of the new guy trying to understand how to write things, I said, well, it's indeterminate because I can't determine what it is. But, yeah, zero is fine with us.
Representative?
Thank you. This committee 2 years ago had a hearing looking at impediments to getting to production, and one of the issues that we brought up was permanent roads, and such as that. And I think at the time we found that there was no statutory requirement that there couldn't be roads. Is there a statutory requirement that we need to change, or is that simply the policy of the department?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I believe that's correct. I don't think it's a statutory issue, but I do know that it is in the area-wide lease sale best interest finding that exploration be conducted on ice roads and ice paths.
Follow-up. Representative Seaton?
So that's in the department's ability to look at that best interest finding. I mean, the legislature was here, and the Resources Committee scheduled hearings, had testimony. There was nothing that we can do because it's in the department's court to its best interest finding and policy. So I guess we're frustrated because we've tried to advance the issue of allowing those main corridor roads that make sense for other development, but it's not anything that we've restricted. And so I just want to make sure that we are, again, telling the department that the legislature, or at least this committee of the legislature, thinks that we need to revisit that policy and that finding, but it's not our finding. And so that we encourage the department to go forward, and that's about all we can do, I think, unless... Because I don't think statutorily we can come in here and change your best interest finding. So
sounds like a great bill title, though.
go build gravel roads.
Yeah.
Do it now.
But I think, Mr. Chairman, I'm just wanting to make sure that it's on the record that this committee did have hearings, did establish that the committee in the legislature was very receptive to that best interest finding being revised, and that's that policy of DNR to effectuate those main corridor roads that would enhance the ability of development in the state. I mean, we did talk about in the other lease that you have out at Mount Spur, we were funding $70 million for gravel road to that section. So where we have attempted to get to those leases, I think that there's, I would just suggest that the department needs to come forward and revise its best interest finding of how we move forward. So otherwise, the legislature, the committee's done pretty much all we can do to push the department in that direction, and at some point it's up to the department to do what you're talking about would be useful to the development on it, whether it's West Cook Inlet or it's Badami or those things, and come forward and reanalyze the policy. So thanks.
Representative Wilson.
I would like to hear your comments about if you're thinking about doing something like that or why you wouldn't.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's one of the roles that the division plays is also the protector of the land, the protector of state land. And given the nature of exploration, it by definition should be temporary. So when you're thinking, especially on the North Slope, when you're thinking about putting in a permanent road for a single well to be drilled, and we're putting in now a road that is going to impact the land forever, if you don't know that there's something there, there's good reason to make it a temporary road, and the best way to do that is a nice road. So we're trying to protect the land. It's an environmental protection that the division is trying to maintain a standard of, because we just don't want roads to nowhere. Bad choice of words for a lot of reasons. But the nature of exploration is just that. That's a scar on the land for possibly no value. And that's the concern we have. So we're quite passionate about that. But if there is an area where, you know, an ongoing development, and that's why I talk about Badami. I mean, that is something that the state has co-sponsored ice roads to Badami every year for drilling activities. And now we're talking about Point Thompson, which is just further down the ice road trail from Badami. But when you know that you've got a development is where we should start making the hard push for road access, not during the exploration phase. I think there's good reason to have that protection.
Representative Wilson?
How many permanent roads do you have up there then? Because we've been doing oil up there for years and 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 years. And so why isn't that happening?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I was just looking over my shoulder. The map on the wall of North Slope, this big map, actually identifies all the road system that's up there.
And those are permanent roads?
Those are permanent roads, yes, ma'am. So there's a road to every well site. There's a road to every primary flow station, every gathering center. There's a road between Dead Horse and Kaparik. There's the infrastructure in the existing fields is robust. Okay. It's the when you step away from that, for example, the area just south of Dead Horse that Great Bear has acquired the acreage for. They're doing some of their exploration work on existing gravel pads right off of the highway, right? Rather than do the ice road and ice pad. And that was a waiver that was granted by my office so they could do that. Once it's in development, very strong case, and the roads are built because it's daily activity. It's okay. And that's kind of where I was going to. With the indulgence of the chair relative to the fiscal note, I wanted to make sure that people said that's a revenue-neutral kind of discussion. Zero out on revenue, not an indiscriminate positive. So from a revenue source, we think that it would be zero, given the balance between leases to be put back in the lease sale versus activity associated and the delays in that lease sale and the value of the work programs, et cetera. So the revenue to the state would be zero.
Okay. Any further questions from committee? At this time, go ahead and open up public testimony on House Bill 198. Do we have anyone in the room here that would like to testify? And I believe we have one online. And at this time, we'll go to Lisa Parker, representing Apache.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Parker, and I'm manager of government relations for Apache Corporation and a resident of Soldotna. On behalf of Apache, thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 198. As you're aware, this bill would allow the commissioner to extend the terms of oil and gas leases or gas-only leases beyond the original primary term. This legislation offers an alternative to last-minute rushes to create units. Proposed placement of rigs or other lease-saving operations would allow an operator to hold its oil or gas lease. The department has seen this done on a repeated basis using valuable time while the company continues to hold the unit or oil and gas lease while requesting further extensions with no actual work being performed. Apache in general is supportive of this legislation. As a new operator in Alaska, we've acquired a significant amount of acreage which has leases that will expire before we're able to complete our seismic exploration activities, which help us delineate what, if any, potential oil and gas leases are under our leases, resources are under our leases. Since entering Cook Inlet in the fall of 2010, Apache has been aggressive in exploration and development efforts. Apache has and continues to find new and innovative ways to conduct seismic so as to create only the slightest disturbance while gathering good quality data. We've employed a cutting-edge technology that in 2012 resulted in acquiring over 200,000 acres of seismic data within the Cook Inlet Basin. Plus, we spud our first well in the fall of 2012. There's still a lot of work left to do, and in working with the department, Apache's hopeful we'll have the opportunity to continue its 3D program to better identify the potential of Cook Inlet. In a letter submitted, we've identified a couple of areas we'd like to see the committee consider as changes. One is the deleting posting of a performance bond. And the second area is changing the sentence requiring, instead of $250 per acre lease, that the lease not to exceed 150% of the rate for the preceding year of the lease term. In closing, Apache would urge support of this legislation. As Apache's general manager, John Hendricks, has stated on numerous occasions, Apache does not sit on its assets. We want the opportunity to bring these leases into production, and to do this, we need to delineate those assets before beginning exploration efforts. This is why we have worked with Representative Olson and the Labor and Commerce Committee and the administration on this issue. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and be happy to answer any questions the committee or members may have.
Questions from the committee for Ms. Parker? Thank you, Ms. Parker. We appreciate you taking the time to testify. Do we have anybody else online? Anybody else in the room? Okay, at this time, we'll close public testimony. Discussion on the bill. Representative Seiler.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, it sounds like a good flexible tool to offer the Division of Oil and Gas to encourage production, to have flexible terms to modify it to suit each individual circumstance. And I think given the imperatives to quickly produce new sources of natural gas for South Central and North Alaska, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it's a good idea.
I tend to agree. It helps allow the state to kind of standardize its lease periods, give adequate time to all entities that are interested in producing oil and gas that is certainly then generates tax revenue for the state of Alaska. It seems to put the interests of the state and the interests of the companies in greater alignment. And I think that probably the most valuable is it takes leases that could potentially expire and then suffer a certain period of time before they went back into the pool for release, allows work that may have already been started in good faith to continue and will result in production from more of our lands sooner, which again goes towards our goal of trying to increase production across the state. So, Representative Hawker, do you have a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, at the appropriate time, would you?
I'll give the mic.
Yes, Mr. Chair, at the appropriate time and with your indulgence, based on the testimony we heard, I would like to move that the committee adopt a zero fiscal note to go along with this legislation.
Hearing no objection, the committee will adopt a zero fiscal note. And at this point, what is the will of the committee? Our Representative Tuck, question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I see this is a good piece of legislation also to make sure that the state's best interest to get production off the leases that we have up there now, allowing the companies to have more time to be able to allow themselves to get to more production. And I see it, I do see it as a win-win situation for both parties and making it happen. And if they don't, of course, they pay the additional penalties and everything else. But and as a 10-year maximum, I think that's very reasonable. I think it's very well thought out.
Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just also wanted to comment in support of the legislation. And I think we've talked about the duty to produce. I think it enforces that concept, and having that 7-3 arrangement gives the state a little bit of power in sort of making sure that there's work being done. And I think that's a good move, and so I support it.
Representative Wilson?
Are you ready for a motion?
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Representative Wilson?
I move House Bill number 198, version C, out of committee with revised to fiscal note, zeroed out fiscal note, and individual recommendations.
Hearing no objections, so moved. Folks, stay around to sign the paperwork. Is there any other business the committee would like to consider?
Yep, so thank you.
No problem.
It's out of order.
We'll accept
anything.
I'll go 111. We'll accept. Thanks. Yes.
Well, with that, at the time of 2:40, a new record, we are adjourned.